You're listening to Draft Chaff. Coming up this week.
Yeah, especially with people so up in arms about one drops, right?
And there's a conversation to be had about payouts in terms of like gem rewards, right? We didn't even get into that.
Expected value. I was kind of reflecting on it and thinking I had a lot of fun even while coming up just short. So I think I'm in a good place.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Draft Chaff. This is episode number 194. My name is Zach. I'm one of your hosts, and joining me, as per usual, Ben Fisher. How's it going, dude?
It's going pretty well. I had a big weekend of tournaments. Some wins, some losses. There's the old adage, first is the worst, second is the best. I've really taken that to heart after this weekend.
Okay. Can't wait to hear more about that. And it sounds like I'm going to have an opportunity to do just that in a moment. But before we get into that, of course, our usual housekeeping. If you're not already in the Discord, do check it out. It's the best place to be to chat all things MTG. Come say hi, post about your trophies, discuss different picks and pick orders and things like that. And you can check that out from our episode description where you can find the link or on our Twitter page. If you'd like to support the show directly, you can do so on Patreon at patreon.com/draftchaffpod. Huge thanks to everybody who continues to support us each and every week. We are super grateful for all of you. Perks over there include things like our Draft Chaff Hero stickers, which we're still waiting to announce for our next one, as well as videos from Ben and I, our show notes, our pre-show recordings. A fun one this week for the pre-show. Not at all Magic related. So if you want to get some hot takes from us about weddings, you can go over there to the Patreon and check out the pre-show for this episode.
We've got some hot takes.
But with that, I think we're ready for our Cracker Draft type thing. Ben, we have a pack one pick two, it looks like.
Yeah, pack one pick two. This is going to be a quick one because honestly, it's a very clear pick. I pack one pick one sharp-eyed rookie that one in the green 2/2, and whenever something evolves it, whenever something comes in with a greater power or toughness, you put a counter on it and you get a clue. Simple card, elegant, nice. It is vigilance too, because why not? And honestly, I was looking for like a good green thing that has a bigger power and toughness to slam after it. And I had some options in pack one, pick two. V2 Ghazi Inspector, that's a 1/3, so it kind of pairs with it. Unknown Crocodile or Undercover Crocodelf, that one. I guess you mostly turn face up, so that's a bit of a nombo with Sharp-Eyed Rookie, but you can just cast it for 6. There's some other junk in this pack. There's a Public Thoroughfare, which I like in 5-color decks, Rumble Belt Bragger, Pete Offender, Benthic Criminologist, all kind of junk. There's a Market Watch Phantom. Couldn't fault you anyone for taking this here. Just go Green-White Detective Beatdown. That's a very strong deck. There's a Gravestone Strider, which is a lot better in this format than you'd think. The 2-mana 1/3, and it filters on 1 mana each turn. It's great at resolving those 4-5-color mana issues where usually the cards are splashing. I mean, this still kind of has guild set implications. So usually just fixing one color a turn gives you perfect mana. Now, in our uncommons, we've got a Vengeful Tracker, a Crime Novelist, and a Case File Auditor. 3 uncommons that don't really have any vector direction that you're interested in here. Case File Auditor and Crime Novelist both have very clearly defined vector directions. I just don't think either of them are that strong. Like Crime Novelist, yeah, are you cracking a million clues? This is better in like Commander or some nonsense. Case File Auditor, if you have a high enchantment density, like if you have a bunch of cases and also maybe a couple makeshift bindings and a bird in the garden, then Case File Auditor gets really good because it grabs any enchantment. But none of these really pair well with the Sharp-Eyed Rookie. Out of all the commons and uncommons, I take the Market Watch Phantom. But
yeah, seems reasonable. I think I think with your first pick, you probably wouldn't want to do this, but I could potentially see wanting to take the Case File Auditor and then just like scoop up every case you find from then on out. But I don't know, is a case deck even good?
It's just so reliant on high rarity cards. There are definitely some good cases, but everyone else is kind of taking them too. Here's the fun thing though. We got past a rare, and it's Niv-Mizzet Guild Pack. People need to stop passing me this card because this is my pet card of the format. It's sort of my weakness. I just don't pass it. I see it, I'm like, yeah, I can probably play that. Notice here I have exactly one card, it's mono green. I'm like, yo, I can play a 5-color. So for those that don't know, It costs Wuber. It gets a 6/6 flying, and it has hexproof from monocolored, or from multicolored rather. So monocolored kill spells can still get it, which there are a bunch. But it does have hexproof for multicolored, which makes it a little harder for some of the kill spells in the format to take it down. And then it says when it deals combat damage to a player, it deals X damage to any target, and then target player draws X cards and gains X life, where X is the number of two color pairs among permanents you control. So basically, for each guild you control on your battlefield, it pays you off. There are some really cool payoffs for having Niv on the battlefield. I think the most cards I've drawn off of it was 4. So I had 4 different guilds represented at once. Obviously, killing their X4, drawing 4, gaining 4, and then doing that every time you hit, that's super busted. The trick is just being able to cast this massive thing.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this early in the draft, you're just windmill slamming Niv. And if you don't end up going 5-color, you don't end up going 5-color. But, like, what better payoff do you have to go 5-color?
Yeah, that's the funny thing. There's a couple different flavors of the 4-to-5-color decks. Fixing is solid enough, even with stuff like Gravestone Strider, I like really highly. Public Thoroughfare is much worse. You can't really take turn 2 off to play a tap land, and not when Market Watch Phantom is running around. So Niv-Mizzet, it is very castable. I've cast it turn 5, I've cast it turn 4 before, but it's not the only way to go 5-color. It's just my favorite way. The other version is actually the Case File Auditor deck, where you are kind of playing like an enchantment multicolor case build. You can do that, it just comes together less often. But in my personal opinion, the 5-color decks are at their best when there's a copy of Niv. So I slam Niv early. I'm not a coward. But at the same time, I'm going to need everyone to stop passing this card because it is tanking my win rate. I'm doing kind of well. A good 5-color Niv deck, I can reliably 2-1 with. But then every once in a while, you'll play against red-white, and it's like, all right, I accept.
Yeah, you got me. Pack it up.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this week we are talking, well, actually a few main topics. But to start, Ben, you really wanted to kind of dive into something we haven't talked too explicitly about on the show before. We've made mention of it. We've kind of dabbled with the topic. But you kind of wanted to dive deep on best of 3 or best of 1. Which should you be playing? What are the payoffs? What are the maybe the downsides of playing either? Let's get into it.
So later, I do want to talk about the tournament decks that I played over the weekend. I have 5 to tell you all about. These were some fun ones, some good ones, some bad ones, some bad ones that did good, some good ones that did bad, everything in between. But as I was prepping for this big weekend of tournaments that I had, I've been playing a lot of this format. I'm actually starting to enjoy it a little more. I don't think it's, you know, it's not cons or anything, but I actually found the key to my enjoyment, and that's playing best of 3. And I was trying to dig around for why that is. I was playing a lot of best of 3 as prep for the Arena Open and the RCQ that I played in. And I was thinking, man, this feels a lot different than best of 1. Like, it feels noticeably different, both in the matchups that you play and how the games play out, in the cards that are good. And I even saw some mumblings on Twitter this week. I think maybe it was Corticals or someone else had tweeted something else talking about how the hand smoother and how card design has influenced the way certain games have constructed and limited feel in the past couple of years. So I think I've come up with a hypothesis. I do actually think, because of the nature of best of 1, for me personally, I find it strictly better to play best of 3 on Arena. And it's a shame that it doesn't have a ladder or a ranking system, because let's be honest, it's fun to climb up the Mythic and get the gem payout and occasionally make top 1200 and have the cool little thing next to your name and whatever. But as far as actually playing the game goes, I think best of 3 is just better. And let me see if I can convince the listener. Now, I'm not saying jump off Arena entirely, go play on Modo and, you know, live in the dark ages. No, I don't think it's that bad yet. But I do think there's 2 main axes we have to consider here, and that's the card design they've been doing recently and the hand smoother. So first off, the card design.
Yeah, well, I think I just wanted to kind of throw in there too. It's interesting to talk about this now, because we've had, geez, I don't even remember when Arena released, but we've had a handful of years now with best of 1 kind of being the de facto way to play Magic. And so we do actually have a litany of evidence really to show whether one should feel or be better to play than the other. So this should be pretty interesting, because it's backed by a lot of games, right? Like we played a lot of best of 1, a lot of best of 3. You get to kind of compare the two.
Yeah, and I do actually think this format rewards best of 3 a little more than most. for a certain contextual reasons. I think there's some where playing best of one versus best of three is less noticeable of a difference. But this one in particular. Now, I actually put card design in quotation marks because, as has been noted by many in recent times, they sort of use this like checklist, right? There's the 6-mana gain 3 life card. There's the 2-mana, 1 of the blue, 3-power defender that can lose defender when you do the thing that the blue keyword vector cares about. It's getting kind of old. And it's safe. It means that sets are, they have less variance overall. But it also means that there's less risks taken and there's less a chance that the last set is going to feel different than the next one. Sets all kind of feel the same in the way that they play out. And this design has tended towards a bit of power creep, and that's natural. I think Magic's actually done a really good job of preventing power creep. Like, if you look back at some good cards from however many years ago, I mean, look at Thraben Inspector. It's still good today, right? They got that one, right? I mean, it was really good back then, too. But, I mean, there's still a lot of cards that are appropriately powered. But I think bombs have changed the nature of how we define a bomb in Limited. It used to be that a bomb, you weren't too worried about your opponent's bombs coming down until turn 5, turn 6. It's like, oh, wow, they played that 6-mana 6/6 flying lifelink. Like, man, I can't beat that. But now, I mean, Fable, the Mirror Breaker, Preacher of the Schism, Wojak Investigator from this more recent set, you can name a bunch more. 3-mana bombs exist. 3-mana cards that are single-handedly capable of ending games exist. And this sort of pushes the entire curve lower. Because to compete against your opponent's 3-mana bombs, to give yourself the best chance, well, you should play things earlier. You should have interaction that costs 2 and 3 instead of 5 and 6. They used to put a 5-mana deal 5 in every set. That's just bad now.
Yeah, it's actually interesting that you bring that up because as you were kind of talking, I made the connection, right? I'm realizing we've seen this happen before. We just have never seen it happen in Limited because we'll see it very regularly with, I don't know, say Modern or even older formats where, you know, like a card will come out, a new set will be released and a card will be shown spoiled or whatever. And folks will look at it and say like, wow, that's a really good card. I'd love to put that in my burn deck, for instance, but it's 3-mana instead of 1 or 3-mana instead of 2. So I can't actually justify playing it because it's too slow. The format's too quick to enable that. And in Limited, we generally haven't cared because, well, we're playing with the entire set and sure, we may have some bombs that are, you know, powerful, but we don't see them that often. So it kind of doesn't matter. And like we have this general slew of cards that we can kind of work with. And inside the context of a limited environment, everything's kind of relative to each other. So it really doesn't matter. But we actually are seeing that now from set to set. And it is harming the playability of Limited, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially with people so up in arms about one drops, right? I do think that one of the best ways to compete with these turn 3 bombs is to curve out, go 1, 2, 3, 4 overrun. And then doesn't really matter what they did on turn 3. That's a valid thing to do. So, and also I think card design wise, they have actually intentionally made one drops better over the years. It used to be that I can remember a time when I started learning how to draft. If there was a one drop in your pack, it could be a rare one drop. It could be a pushed one drop. You still wouldn't look at it. Because it costs 1 mana, and by default, it was going to be worse than a card that costs 3 mana. Like a 1 mana rare would probably be worse than a 3-mana 3/3 in most cases.
Yeah, and actually, I can recall a time, probably around the same period of time that you're talking about, where we would often hear from, well, maybe not often, but we would hear on shows like Limited Resources, Marshall and other co-hosts, right, like, pointing out, wow, we actually got a one drop that's playable this set, or man, we haven't had a one drop that's playable in ages. It would be nice.
Rare.
You know, they would comment on it because it was such a deep, like a big deal to have a one drop that was playable.
Now it's like
every set, there's like 3 or 4 of them. Yeah.
Yeah. If my opponent is on the play and they play a turn 1 novice inspector, I feel like I'm already going to lose. I could have a novice inspector in my hand. But the fact that they're on the play and had their own turn 1 board affecting card, I also think this contributes to the play draw issue, where sets more recently have had the biggest play draw incongruency ever.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, forgive me putting the tinfoil hat on a little bit here, I do think this was intentional. I think we've seen since Arena launched, right? They introduced this idea of best of one. We saw it in other digital first card games like Hearthstone, like Legends of Runeterra. Best of one just kind of is the default online format. And so they tried it with Arena. It was really never a thing in Magic prior to Arena. Everywhere you could play in any kind of competitive scenario, even like the lowest RELs, best of three. That was all you played.
That's true.
You had always had sideboard options. That was just how the game worked. Arena introduced best of one for the first time, or at least for the first time on a large scale. And I think they intentionally have been shifting game set design, not just with best of one in mind, but to intentionally shorten the length of games so people will play more of them. Mm-hmm. We saw kind of comments early on about how best of one, right, like is more or less is there to make it so that you can just pick up, and especially once Arena released on the phone, you can just pick it up, play a game quick. If games are 15 to 20 minutes, great, but like matches will take an hour usually. You know, if you sit down at a store, they usually give you 50 minutes to play a round or so.
Yeah.
Not everybody has that amount of time to sit down at their computer and play Magic for an hour. You just want to sit down for 20 minutes and get something in while your kid's napping or whatever. But if they push sets to be more aggressive, if they push sets to be focused more on this like 1-2-3 mana centric kind of mana curve, well, now games are 10 minutes, so you can get two in that same 20 minute period instead of one. And that means you're spending gems. That means you're spending gold. Like, yeah, exactly.
Now, in this set in particular, a set with disguise creatures, back in cons, you could be on the draw and play a morph for your first thing, and the game could still go pretty well for you. That is not how it works anymore. Now, all this isn't even that bad. If this was all the only thing there was, if this is the only thing that had changed in Magic recently, I think we could live. I like playing beatdown decks. I like going 1-2-3, cast, inspiring charge, kill you. But it's compounded, it's multiplied by the hand smoother. And now it's time to really put on the tinfoil hat. I'm not about to say the shuffler's rigged. It's not. You just make a better deck. I don't know what to tell you. Put the right number of lands in. But the hand smoother, it does play a big part into the best of one experience and why I believe best of one is worse. So,
and to clarify, right, for those who don't know, listener, if you're not aware of this,
yeah,
the hand smoother only happens on best of one. You don't get that on best of three.
Exactly. So let me read the exact verbatim release note on the hand smoother. I had to dig for a couple years to find this. It says the system draws an opening hand from each of two separately randomized copies of the deck. And then leans towards giving the player the hand with a mix of spells and lands, without regard for color, closest to average for that deck. You can then use the standard mulligan rules to get a new hand with one fewer card. Mulligan hands are created from a single randomized draw. So this is interesting. Basically, yeah. It pulls two hands for you and says, okay, which one of these more closely matches the deck's mana and to spell distribution? Now, there's some things here that you have to factor in. For example, I had a deck over the weekend that had two copies of Analyze the Pollen. It's a green spell that goes and searches for a land. Now, I could have played both of those and then played like a 16 land or maybe even 15 land if my curve was lower. 15 lands, two Analyze the Pollen. They're basically a tapped green land as long as I have a green source in play. But they also have the upside of you can collect evidence, go get a creature in the late game. Now, if you were doing that, maybe with a slightly higher curve with those two, I think maybe 16 lands, two Analyze the Pollen, a medium mid-range curve. If you're playing best of one, that might mean that it more often gives you two landers instead of three landers in your opener. And then maybe you don't have Analyze the Pollen in hand because you were kind of factoring in those two as copies of lands. That if not factoring in the hand smoother, I mean, it's fine, but factoring the hand smoother, that kind of messes with your math a little bit. Anyway, that's a side note.
Right. Well, because the smoother doesn't care about what your spells do. It's just caring about the distribution of spells to lands relative to the distribution in your deck. So like hand to deck comparisons there.
So overall, you're more likely to see a hand with a mix of spells and lands. And that does seem good, right? For if you're playing one game, they wanted to create less non-games where you have zero lander and you have to mulligan, because if you're just getting one match against this opponent, and then, I mean, that's it. That feels kind of bad. I mean, statistically, I guess it wouldn't really matter in the long run. You have to take those zero landers when you get them in best of three every once in a while. But at least you haven't given up an entire loss because of what feels like random chance. It's more about the feeling of it. Now, that also means that you're more likely to play out your first three lands. And if you're playing out your first three lands, you're probably more likely to play out your first several spells. And then let's say you're playing a deck with cheap cards, which say the game has incentivized playing cheap cards recently. See the previous 5 minutes of the show for that. They've been doing that. It means you're more likely to play a 1 into 2 into 3 drop. The hand smoother, the net result, I believe, is more conducive to decks that want to go turn 1 land 1 drop, turn 2 land 2 drop, turn 3 land 3 drop, than decks that are trying to maybe draw cards, build towards a wrath, build towards late game bomb, ramp into spells. The hand smoother, it punishes the aggro decks less. It benefits them more. And
this everybody
multiplies
else
the
does,
strength
yeah.
of the aggressive vectors. So, I mean,
yeah.
If you're playing best of one, it does kind of become strictly better. And sure, I'm sure there's people out there who have done the math on this and crunched the exact numbers of aggro decks. And I've even seen things claiming that you should never play 17 lands. You should only ever play 16 or 18. I don't want this to be a primary... Well, it's not right at the forefront, right? I'm still drafting my deck like I always would. I'm still building my deck like I always would. But I think I've allowed this encroachment to creep in for too long. I think I've gotten too used to playing best of one. And given that I wanted to practice for a competitive best of three setting, when I actually started playing best of three, I noticed some real differences.
Yeah, and it's honestly, it's a dumb lever to be able to pull to increase win percentage, right? This isn't even like you're not really getting better at the game. You're getting better by paying attention to this mechanic of Arena. You're getting better at gaming Arena than you are at playing
exactly.
Magic. And that feels really bad because also when you sit down to play in paper, if you're ever doing that, that's not relevant. And so like it's a skill you're putting energy and effort into that really only has an application on Arena. And that just feels bad. And it's also to your point, multiplying the strength of like these aggressive vectors and then them also incentivize like designing decks to be more aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
It just artificially expands the gap between aggressive and let's say less aggressive decks, right? Your control
exactly.
decks are now automatically like the gap in playability between them is that much worse, even though sure the control decks are going to be able to play their first three lands out as well. They just also typically have more expensive spells, so they can't cast any of them.
Yeah. So for me personally, and if you prefer the best one experience for whatever reason, like Zach mentioned, like maybe you only have 10 minutes for that, best one's great. I do gym drafts, right? I'm on the treadmill, I'm drafting. I do best one there because, you know, I got to do different sets and I have different timings. Sometimes I'll be like, oh, I got to go back inside soon. My internet's going to shift between the Wi-Fi out there and in my, like, there's great reasons to play best of one for sure. Also, it's time efficient. If you're playing the Arena Open and want to make day two, and if you're really trying to game it, I do think best of one is probably the correct choice. Unless your win rate is really high, then best of three, I think, is better. And you're just, I don't know. There's probably a bunch of math you can do with that too. But anyway.
Sure. And there's a conversation to be had about payouts in terms of like gem rewards, right? We didn't even get into that.
Expected value.
Expected value based on your win rate. And I think there's an argument for people who like, okay, I'm going to accept the fact that this hand smoother thing is a part of playing best of one, but hey, I very much more like I more often will 4-3 or 5-3 than I can 3-0. And if I played best of three, I would have to put cash into the game. And if I play best of one, I don't often have to do that. So there's a limiting factor there too. And you're kind of just deciding, okay, I'm going to choose to have this extra kind of lever to the game that I need to pay attention to if I want my win rate to go up or versus like not spending as much money.
Mm-hmm. Like, I've checked the numbers. I have a high enough win rate where I believe I'm supposed to play best of three when entering Arena Open day one sealed pools. Because the payout, it actually gives you gems back for getting one or two match wins, even if you don't get all four that you need. And that way, if you get three match wins, I believe it gives you back your cost of entry so you can refire. But then, that takes like 3 hours. I don't have that on a Saturday sure. morning. Like, I got stuff to do. Anyway, I've been playing a lot of best of three. I've been practicing writing down spells, combat tricks, counter spells, disguise things, anything that my opponent shows me in game one, because I've been trying to maximize my amount of fun I have, which through winning, right? Through winning games. And I think that for me to become the best possible Magic player in order to win an RCQ, which I came very close to this weekend, I will need to start getting better at that sort of stuff. I think best of one has actually dulled my senses. It has made me worse. And in the fact that I'm no longer thinking about combat tricks, I think about the ones in the set, but I have lost a bit of the art of playing best of three, where if my opponent shows me a two mana pump spell in game one, I want to be thinking about that two mana pump spell in game two. And over this weekend, I punished myself when I didn't think about it. There was an explicit attack that I made that I had even written down the pump spell that they had in game one. I should not have made that attack. I should have checked my notes and seen oh, they have that pump spell. This is a silly attack to make. They have two mana up. If they make this block and then pump their creature, I'm going to lose here. And that's exactly what happened. So there's other good reasons for playing best of three as well. I actually think there's a lot of fun to be had, and it's rewarding. I played a game in the Arena Open this weekend where I got crushed game one by an opponent who had two copies of Repulsive Mutation. It cost blue, green, X, the counter spell. Put X counters on up to one of your creatures, and then your opponent has to pay X, where X is the greatest power among creatures you control, or counter the spell. So basically a super-powered mana leak that can buff one of your creatures. My opponent had two copies. It's a Simic Bomb, super good. But they had two copies of this counter spell, and in games two and three, I just played around it. Like, it's super obvious when they leave up a five-mana counter spell. If they don't have any morphs to flip or anything, I'm like, oh, they have it. I'm just going to play out my two drop, hope they don't try to counter it, and then pass the turn, crack a clue instead of tapping out. And I really punished my opponent, even getting to a two for one then, where they tried to put a bunch of counters on a creature and counter a combat trick at the same time. And I had my own counter spell ready and waiting. And I won that game because I played around their two really good cards. And that's a rewarding aspect of the game that the best of one simply doesn't have. And honestly, you should draft sideboard picks. Like, that's an important skill unto itself. And that also has been entirely lost among the entire best of one crowd.
Yeah, I almost wonder if we're going to start seeing, I suppose we already have started to see a decline in sideboardable cards. Like, I feel like the sideboard grade for cards is like kind of not much of a thing anymore. And then we've had a few like flashback drafts that have gone onto Arena, and they put in cards that are like some of the removal spells that are like kind of overcosted for whatever they are, but if you're targeting like a green permanent or whatever, it's actually a good rate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those are total sideboard cards that are quite good in the right matchups, and you can bring them in, but you pretty much never want to main deck them. And A, we don't really see any of those anymore. And B, when they did bring them back into Arena, you pretty much, they were just dead cards in the pack because nobody wanted to draft them because everybody was playing best of one.
Yeah, it was a non-card. Like, why is it even there then?
Right.
So that being said, I think I'm going to fully swap to playing best of three. I may still jam the ladder a little bit here or there, but I don't think I'm going to be grinding for Mythic like I used to. I think for now.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, especially for someone like you who's actually looking less toward, and I know you're getting some value out of doing this anyway, but less toward climbing the ladder and more toward practicing for RCQs and other events like that, where your goal really isn't hit the highest rank I can hit. It's, I want reps so I can prepare for a big event.
I
want
to be good at limited, and I don't think best of one is making me good at limited.
Yeah, there you go. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of it dulling senses, because it definitely takes parts of the game away. Mm-hmm. And then, if you ever do, as a listener, if you ever do want to try for an RCQ or try to make it to the Pro Tour or any of these kinds of things, you need to know how to play best of three. And as Ben mentioned, playing best of one and then just trying to tell yourself, okay, sure, I can play best of three, I'm just going to play a few extra games, you're leaving equity on the table because you're not going to have certain skills that you just need to be good at best of three. It's a different game.
Yeah. Take it
now,
from me.
Question for you, Ben, that we haven't touched on yet. We're talking about this in NKM, which is a set that introduced play boosters. So do you feel that play boosters have impacted your desire to play best of three now over best of one? Do you feel like this has been something that's been mounting over the last few sets, even agnostic of play boosters being introduced? How does play boosters kind of get brought into this equation?
I guess, well, the reason that I said MKM is different than most is actually because of the disguise creatures. You get really rewarded if you can play around your opponent's particular disguises in games two and three, or if they have like a really good one or really bad one, keep that one in mind, or if they only show you a couple, maybe even they don't show you any. It does kind of factor in that regard. As to the play booster experience, I haven't actually found it that drastically different than the regular booster experience. Sure, sometimes you wind up with maybe on average half an extra rare in your deck. But that nightmare scenario of like, you're going to get curb stomped by a sealed opponent that opened 15 rares, that doesn't happen all that often and not a measurable amount. I don't think it's worth complaining or thinking too much over. I found it actually to be pretty fun. I'll be honest, it makes packs more fun to open. If you open two potential good rares and then there's had you just opened one of them, you probably just take the rare and move on. But now sometimes there's an interesting pick between two rares all the way in your first pack, not in your second pack when you're comparing between two uncommons. And then it's like, well, if I take this, I had a situation in the RCQ in the Arena Open where I could take either a mono black rare or a black white rare. I was like, man, if I take the mono black rare, well, then I pass the good black white rare, probably putting them into black white, or maybe that just keeps going through them. But if I take the black white rare and cut it, then I'm going to be cut in pack two because my person to my left is going to take this black rare. I've actually found it to just add choice and add thought. And those are things that I like having this game.
Cool. So, I mean, we've talked a lot about these tournaments that you played last weekend. Let's jump into those. Like what events did you do? Let's talk through your decks, how they performed.
Right. So I had a pretty solid run of stuff this weekend. My first one was an RCQ, a sealed RCQ for MKM. My sealed pool was Garbo, except for a Cryptic Coat, which is maybe the best card in the set. Maybe just behind Aurelia's Vindicator, depends who you ask. But Cryptic Coat is nuts. Unfortunately, my blue cards were very bad. So I ended up splashing Cryptic Coat in a black-white deck. Esper. Maybe one of the least winning color combinations on 17 lands, but this is best of three. So, you know, I guess we can't really take best of 17 lands data to mean much for this setting. I mean, I think most of that's based on best of one data, right? At least what I tend to see floating around on Twitter. Now, this deck, it had some action. My white cards were solid. I had a good white core of Novice Inspector, Perimeter Enforcer, Market Watch Phantom, Inside Source, Makeshift Binding. That white package was strong. But then the only other good stuff I had early, and you really do need to have early plays in the set, was black. And I don't like black that much in the set. I ended up playing a couple Unscrupulous Agent, Extracted Confession, two copies of Alley Assailant, just not that good cards. I had a Treacherous Greed in my pool, the one white black. Sack a creature that dealt damage this turn, and Helix your opponent's face, draw three cards. So a Lightning Helix and an Ancestral Recall stapled together. And I was looking at my pool and I'm thinking, okay, what have I got? Novice Inspector, Fester Leech, two Unscrupulous Agents that when they ETB, your opponent exiles a card from their hands. They already got their value just by entering. Perimeter Enforcer, Sanguine Savior, Cryptic Coat makes repeatable little things you don't care too much about. And the more I looked at my deck, I was like, I actually have a lot of expendable creatures. I think I'm going to play the Treacherous Greed. It ended up being pretty good. I think people are lower on this card than they should be. I don't recommend taking it highly, but I think if you're playing black-white, if you're in a good black-white deck with a lot of little evasive flyers, you should play the Greed. So anyway, I also had a good black card in Deadly Cover-Up, the black board white. But the Cover-Up and the Cryptic Coat were by far my two best cards. This Esper deck was pretty junky. I didn't do very well if I didn't draw the coat, but I did well enough. I ended up going 3-1 with this, and I intentionally drew into the top 8 after that.
Very nice.
Now, my top eight deck, I opened my first pack. This was my first ever RCQ top eight. So I got the top eight draft for the first time. That was very exciting. Pack one, pick one. I see a War Leader's Call. Slam it. Just the red white anthem that has the Impact Tremors staple to it. Awesome. I'm like, all right, I'm drafting red white. I don't care what's happening around me. I pick up a Neighborhood Guardian, and then from there, I just kind of am off to the races. But then white kind of gets cut, and I'm like, okay, this is a little awkward. I'm not getting a lot of white cards. I was able to pick up stuff like a Galvanize, a Person of Interest. But then I got some junk like Granite Witness, Gadget Technician, not really what you want in your efficient red-white beatdown deck. You prefer just a bunch of inside sources. But then, pick six, I get a Meddling Youths, and I'm like, oh, so red white. We're back in
like a signal. Yep.
Yeah. The 5-mana 4/5 haste, super strong. Love this card. And I'm like, okay, we're in. Pack two, I get past a bunch of good white stuff. I get past Auspicious Arrival, Not on My Watch, Novice Inspector. And I'm like, okay, we're back. We're safe. White is good. I'm going to get a bunch of white from the side. I even managed to pick up an On the Job. And then going back the other way, it kind of worked out the same. I got another late Meddling Youths, a Fuss and Bother, nothing too interesting. I ended up with a solid red-white beatdown deck. And red-white, after having looked at the rest of the drafters, I was the only red-white drafter. But the person to my right was playing a five-color soup deck. So they were taking all the good red and white cards, just not for red-white. So like they wound up with a dog walker that I would have gotten otherwise. And that was a big bummer to know that. I could have had that dog walker in my deck, but five color soup can play it. So anyway, I crushed round one. My deck worked perfectly. I played two drop into War Leader's Call into flooding the board with creatures, and it wasn't even close. And my opponent had a very strong deck. They had Agris Core, Aurelia, and Taysa. So all three of the Mardu bombs, you could say, Mardu legend bombs. But I still flattened them with this red white beatdown. Then things went a little off the rails. That was the first match of the top eight. This was a two slotter, so I had to win one more match to get the invite to Dallas for the RC. A single match win. Unfortunately, in that match, I couldn't get a game win. My opponent had a sick blue-green deck splashing Izoni, which Izoni is sort of the bane of red-white decks in this format. I mean, you just can't attack into it. It gains life if you really need it to. People never even activate that mode. Usually just making a bunch of 2-1 menace reaches is good enough. So I had a good time. My opponents were awesome. I made some friends at this tournament. And the dude who beat me, John, real cool guy, had a lot of fun. Even in our top match playing for the RCQ, we were joking around. So and honestly, the deck, the wheels kind of fell off as I was playing it. I missed my third land drop in one of the games. While on the play, and it just didn't quite
click. Too bad you didn't have that hand smoother.
Honestly, in that, I wished I did. Best of one, this deck would have flattened. This is like a 7-2 best of one deck, I'd say. Anyway, not bad for my first RCQ top eight. Had a lot of fun doing it, and I'm playing another RCQ next weekend. Anyway, I got home that night, and I jammed Arena Open, because I was like, you know what? I've got the competitive itch. I think it took me two bullets to get in, or maybe three. I forget. I got in with a Jund deck. You know, Izoni, I guess Izoni felt bad for kicking me out of the RCQ because I got a pack one, pick one Izoni. And then I got a Vein Ripper. And then I drafted a bunch of good black and green and red stuff to go around it. This deck was sick. It also had an Axebane Ferex and two Tunnel Tipsters. Also an Outrageous Robbery. So I was kind of Jund rare pile. That deck went 7-2 to get me to day two. All now, right. The first draft, I played sort of like a teamer good stuff. I opened kind of all total junk. I took, I think, a Sample Collector pack one, pick one. Not very good at all. But then the person to my right just didn't like green and passed me in order Arc Druid's Charm and Kellen. And I was like, all right, I'm not going to complain. I was able to pick up a case of Locked Hot House after that. And then I splashed Galvanize and Shock. I had a bunch of other good green cards, Tunnel Tipster, Nervous Gardener, Fanatic Strength, some good blue cards, Out Cold, Furtive Courier, Jaded Analyst, Hard-Hitting Question. And this was the Analyze the Pollen deck. I actually ended up only playing one of them. But being able to Analyze the Pollen to tutor out Kellen, this is just really strong. So this is a 3-match win deck, which meant that in my second draft of the day, I only had, it was single limb, one match loss, and I was out. Now, this is where things went off the rails again. In Arena Open draft number 2, playing for the $2,000, I pack one, pick one, Taysa. Good card, the black, white rare. I'm like, all right, I've had some success with a black, white deck this weekend. Maybe Taysa can get me there. But then white was super cut. I didn't see a single good white card for all of pack one. I picked up some solid blue and green stuff. Cold Case Cracker, Culvert Ambusher, Buried in the Garden, Ill-Timed Explosion. I sort of started leaning towards a teamer pile. Then pack two, what do I open? Bakaya, another black white on color mythic. I'm like, cool. All I'm right. Very glad black and white have been cut from both sides. So I ended up actually splashing Taysa and Kaya in my teamer deck. So I had good fixing. I had Bird in the Garden, Tunnel Tipster to ramp, a bunch of dual lands that I could play, and I had Branch of Udagazi, Escape Tunnel, as good fixing pieces. And honestly, I think the splash was correct. I was able to cast both pretty reliably on curve, and Kaya performed very well. It's a Planeswalker Unlimited. What do you expect? That being said, this deck was garbage. I would not... Of the 5 decks that I have mentioned so far, this is by far the worst. I would take any of the other 4 above it in any context. And honestly, I was so lucky to get a single match win from it, mostly because my opponent got stuck on 2 lands during one of our games. So I took the 15,000 gems and got demolished in match 2. And I was like, all right, I'm out.
Well, sounds like a pretty solid weekend overall. I mean, yeah, you didn't quite make it on any of the events you played, but you got pretty close for all of them.
Yeah, and to be honest, the follow-up prizes were fine. Making top 4 of an RC gets you around $100 in store credit in the place that I played, and 15,000 gems translates to, I think, like 150 real-world dollars. So, you know what? Second place in all these events. And I say second in the Arena Open because had I won a single more match, I would have cashed the 500. And then past then is whatever. So felt sure. Like a weekend of coming up just short. But I was kind of reflecting on it and thinking I had a lot of fun even while coming up just short. So I think I'm in a good place.
Yeah, I mean, you're sounding very positive about, especially when like the latter part of your events goes off the rails a little bit. That can be kind of tilting because you know you're so close. And especially as you were saying, you were one win away from cashing both the Arena Open and the RCQ. I could see that being really tilting. But, you know, for you to come out of an RCQ near win, you know, a loss in the top 8 and get home and be like, you know what? I'm still feeling the competitive itch. Let me hop on the Arena Open and just jam some more arena that or some more magic, really. That says a lot, I think, for your mindset toward competitive magic right now, kind of regardless of the set.
Yeah, thanks. It was honestly a lot of fun. I felt like I made good use of my time, made a lot of friends at the RC. It was a game store I hadn't been to before. Really cool crowd what was it called? New World Manga Comics and Games in where was that? Lambert? No. I forget. Somewhere in North Jersey. Cool place. I recommend it to anyone in the area. And honestly, excited for the next one. I'll be at the Hex and Company RCQ in Brooklyn next week. So in Brooklyn? Maybe it's the Manhattan one? I forget. It's one of the Manhattan ones. So hopefully I'll have a better tournament report to come out of that one. But honestly, if there's a time to lose, if I have to lose in a Magic tournament, I do want it to be as late as possible.
Yeah, you know, second let me get place as many games good. As I
can. Yeah.
All right. Well, that brings us to our listener question of the week. This week, our question comes from Rem Speedwagon in the Discord. If you could pick a theme for a set that hasn't been done yet, either mechanically or story-wise, what would it be?
I'm going to say right now, just because it's big, just because it's the current hype, Universes Beyond Dune. That's all I want. It would be so sick. I mean, Magic has already pulled a lot of influence from Dune, as have all fantasy and sci-fi works in many ways. A lot of them have taken from Dune and borrowed from it.
Sure.
I think that could be pretty sweet. As for other overall themes, they haven't really done like a, I guess they sort of touched on this in Theros, but I think like a sports theme could be kind of fun, like a big competitive I guess we know in 2026 or whatever, they're doing like a competitive racing thing. Oh, yeah, yeah. So, like, that was sort of it. But what if instead of, like, a fighting tournament, it was, like, a, I don't know, like a ping pong tournament? Or I'm turning to anime for some inspiration here because, you know, a lot of sports anime end up really popular. Other ones are sort of like just slice of life. Obviously, magic is combat focused. Like, the name of the game is trying to beat up another player, right? But right. I almost would want to see some more just like, you know, what about when the multiverse isn't in chaos and there isn't a giant existential threat? There's no Eldrazi titans or gods or boluses or who cares? Let me just see what happens when you're on Kaladesh and it's tax season coming up and you just built this giant artifact and it's glowing and the HOA is on your case and you're like, man, I'd like to see some of that too. How about you?
Do we think we're going to get it in Bloomborough?
Maybe that one might be a little more slice of life. I hope we get to see some animals doing their thing, but even those little animals, they got swords and stuff.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, I think it's going to be par for the course with a game like Magic that is very combat oriented. It's like, how do you turn, well, I can think of a few ways to turn tax season into a combat oriented scenario, but
they'll all get like, put on a watch list.
Right. You can't like take that part of the game away unless you're like changing the game altogether. Right. So, it would be interesting to see how they could get away from this cookie. They would definitely have to get away from this cookie cutter approach to set design to do something like that. So that would be fun.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, you know, one of the first things that came to mind was maybe something like steampunky. They kind of did cyberpunk and I guess Kaladesh was kind of steampunk, but not really. So maybe something steampunk-esque would be fun. We've gotten like pretty much all of the major mythologies, at least that come to mind for me in one way or another, whether that's through like Ixalan or, you know, Amonkhet or Theros or whatever.
Even like, back to when they did like stuff like Arabian Nights, that they're referring to a lot of fables that are commonplace.
And we got Kaldheim with the Viking, you know, so it's like we got a lot of the mythologies. It kind of would be cool to see something a little more real world, kind of harkening back to the Arabian Nights style. Like, I don't know, like an American Revolutionary War kind of thing might be fun. But that almost feels a little bit too like real. I don't know that that would go over well in modern day. Like Arabian Nights worked, but that was about a time period that was like generally still, you know, still very far in the past. And
let's be honest, super they didn't really have the best cultural consultants on that one.
No, not at all.
There's some that certainly don't fly these days.
Right. So yeah, and I don't know that that would go over very well today either. And in execution, story wise. Yeah, I don't know. I'm a little disheartened. Disheartened's maybe not the right word, but I've been like caring less about the story lately. It's like, I feel like they've done all of these big, to your point, right? Like they've done all these big, bad, like the universe or multiverse is ending scenarios. And it's like, okay, we've gotten a bunch of those and all the big bads have kind of been defeated now. Like there aren't really any more that we know of, except Emmy stuck in the moon, who apparently isn't stuck in the moon anymore or whatever. Yeah. Like they've done it all. So it's like, I don't know. I'm a little bit tired of the big multiverses ending stuff. All right. Well, with that, on to our Teferi Tibble. This is our Roses and Thorns style of segment where Ben and I share a high and a low from the past week. Ben, how was your week? What's going on?
It was a week, you know, I mean, I already mentioned my highs and lows of the tournaments. I'm going to say another one of my highs was seeing Dune. I've been looking forward to the new Dune movie for a very long time. And it somehow lived up to the hype, despite the massive amount of hype. It's a solid 5 out of 5 stars for me. Can't wait to see it a second time. Only issue is that it's not more than 3 hours. I could watch 5 hours of that movie. They just crushed it.
I have heard really good things. I have heard it's better than the first. I have not seen it yet, but
can confirm, I would say. Actually, I'm not sure it's even fair. It's almost like it's elevated to a level of mythos where spoilers don't really matter. The larger overarching story, it feels so universal and so real. It's like, oh wow, this is a fully fleshed out thing in this universe. We're just going along with it. And it does actually play really well off of the first story. There's scenes in the first that are made better by the second and vice versa.
Very cool. Yeah, well, I can't wait to watch it. I definitely love the first one. So I'm looking forward to that. But I didn't spend my time this weekend watching that. Instead, I was up in Michigan for a wedding last weekend, which was really great. Just had a lot of fun and good weather too. I mean, it was pretty beautiful this weekend. So outside of some rain here and there, but great temperature. Spring is on the horizon. I got off the plane when I landed back in Jersey on Sunday and like could smell spring in the air, and I'm ready, Ben. I am so ready.
Let's get some warmer weather. Yeah,
for sure. I'm really ready for the spring. My tidbit this week is that I had a crazy busy start to the week. Hopefully it's going to taper off here at the end of the week as we get into that. But so far, very, very busy. Haven't really stopped, and I'm pretty exhausted. Well, that about does it for us this week. Thank you so much for listening. Do check out the Discord if you haven't already. Again, the link to that is in the episode description as well as on our Twitter page. And if you'd like to support the show directly, you can do so on Patreon at patreon.com/draftchaffpod. Again, huge thanks to everybody who continues to support us there. And you can find us on Twitter or X or whatever Elon's calling it these days at draftchaffpod. Thanks, folks, and we'll catch you next week.
So quick sign off. While I was seeing Dune, I went and saw by myself, actually. I was there for a 6:30 showing. And I was like, man, school's over. I just got home. I don't really have time for dinner. I'm just going to get some popcorn at the theater, right? So I go up to the concession stand. I'm like, hey, I'll just get like a large popcorn, right? And I'm like, you don't happen to have any of those buckets left, do you? And the girl at the counter goes, oh, the worm buckets? Yeah, we got tons of them. Do you want one? And I'm like, yeah. So
the worm buckets?
Have you seen this going around?
I have not seen this. What the heck?
It's been all over the internet. The Dune 2 popcorn bucket featuring this rather suggestive.
Yep.
Yeah, it is a worm. And
it is a worm.
Something about this that I can actually say from practice. And look, when I went into that theater, there were maybe two empty seats in the whole thing right in front of the screen. It was packed.
Yeah, I actually heard a statement from the CEO of IMAX that said the only reason we didn't sell more tickets to Dune 2 is that we didn't have more seats.
That honestly checks out. And I'm looking around and I'm seeing not many people actually have the Dune 2 worm popcorn bucket. This is limited edition. This is solid metal here. And this thing is like high quality. This is sturdy. This is a collector's item. And I'm looking around, I'm like, what are these fake fans doing here without their, like, if you're going to come here and get a large popcorn and not get the bucket, how much is a large popcorn? Like $17? This thing was only like $24.
Large popcorn is $17.
Oh, I don't know. I'm just making that up. But it's like,
that's the price
money?
Of a ticket. Holy crap.
I don't know. It probably is, but who knows? Anyway, I'm looking around. I'm like, these idiots, they didn't even get the Dune 2 popcorn bucket. Like, why'd they even come? But here's the problem. See how the teeth face inwards, not unlike the real Shai Hulud, desert maker. So when you reach your hand in, it's sort of like a finger trap, where when you try to pull it out, they all kind of push down on it. So when you grab in popcorn,
you're not getting like any worm, popcorn out.
Yeah, it flicks it back down. It is the most impractical thing I've ever bought, and I love it so much.
Yeah, I was like, you're not buying that to eat the popcorn. You're just buying that to have the bucket. And I don't know. Can you take the lid off or something?
Yeah. But honestly, it was all part of the experience.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.